We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to have you back, Jav.
Thank you, and welcome to another episode of Dysfunctional Families Today.
Slightly different show today for you. Each of us talking about our families.
Post-holiday decompression.
Unfortunately,
rant is the term you were looking for.
Unfortunately, the show's only a half hour, so we're going to have to skip that and go to our usual fare, starting with local and some changes at the SPD.
Yeah, a couple of shakeups at the SPD. Now, last week I talked about how the court-appointed monitor, Merrick Bob, had released his semi-annual report on the Seattle Police Department's progress on police reform. And he was very, very critical of SPD's top brass, many of whom he said were resisting reforms. This week, we saw Interim Chief Jim Pugel's response to that. He has about six assistant chiefs in the department who answer to him and who he can hire and fire at will. They're just above the captain level. And this week, he demoted two of them. First, he demoted Assistant Chief Dick Reed, who was in charge of the technology operations for the SPD. Now, Merrick Bob, in his report, was scathing in his assessment of SPD's IT department and their inability to provide correct and complete information to the monitor to do his job. He said that the department had problems not just gathering information, but putting it together and analyzing it and passing it on. In addition, he said they couldn't accurately track data as required under the DOJ agreement, and they had severe problems with the audio and video recordings from cameras in police cars, and that the tracking, logging, and preservation of those videos was sorely lacking.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, and as I said last week, that's been an ongoing problem for quite some time with the SPD, and that apparently not much has been done to fix that. Now, Reed was demoted to his old job of overseeing the 911 call center, and that was kind of interesting. I didn't know where he had been promoted from, and I didn't see that as particularly adequate experience for being in charge of a department that was particularly having problems with the video and audio for the cameras and the police cars. And, you know, that's going to be a huge database, setting up a new database or making changes to whatever database they have in-house and tracking that. It's going to, I think, take some expertise and some technology they probably don't have right now. Now, secondly, this week, Pugel demoted Assistant Chief Nick Metz back to captain. Metz was the head of the Investigation Bureau. And another notable part of Merrick Bob's report was that he criticized the lack of an open, fair, and comprehensive internal investigation into police shootings. Metz, who has often served as a spokesman for the SPD, was seen as one of the staff who was most resistant to changes, and as head of the Investigations Bureau, I'm guessing he probably has some hand in overseeing internal investigations. So that was kind of an interesting demotion. Now, the SPD still has about a three-week window in which to dispute or reply to Merrick Bob's report, and these personnel changes clearly are part of that reply, but, of course, it's by no means an adequate one. Replacing the top guys doesn't necessarily equate, in my mind at least, to substantial changes in the way things are done day to day. And so I think it would be great to actually see a comprehensive plan or policy issued from the SPD for how they're going to, for example, track data collection and how they're going to log and fix the database for their videos, how they're going to make those records public for people who are contesting their arrests or making complaints as far as excessive use of force and so forth. And, you know, now is the time for them to do that, because if they need additional personnel and additional technology in order to fix their in-house data collection system, if they need people to help pull video and audio from cameras after a shift is over, for example, now is the time for them to go to the city council and say, we need the money, now that they have a court-appointed monitor and the judge looking on, it's going to be a lot easier for them to get those resources. And the fact that they haven't done it up till now is, I think, pretty interesting.
Well, also because the city council's in the middle of the budget process, and come early January, we're going to have a new mayor sworn in. One of the first things that Mayor-elect Murray will have to do as mayor is decide whether to keep Pugel as his permanent chief of police or whether to name a new chief of police from outside the department. And so the question with this, which the kind of plan you're talking about would be very helpful in trying to discern an answer to, is whether these are cosmetic changes that are designed primarily to enhance the reform credentials of Pugel without actually doing very much, or whether it's part of a larger process that is, in fact, trying to move SPD forward.
Yeah, and Murray has said that he's putting money into the budget, or he would like the city council to include money in the budget for a search for a new police chief. So, yeah, you're right, Job. I think Pugel might be positioning himself to be in the running as a candidate for permanent chief, but I think to really qualify for that, he's going to have to say, look, we're taking real steps here. We're coming out and saying this is our real plan to fix things.
Yeah, and the fact that Merrick Bob has been so critical in this latest report, even though Pugel has been in charge for 6 months now, tells you not just that there's a lot of institutional change, but that Pugel has not had a strong hand in trying to address that change, and or that he has not pushed strongly himself to address it.
And that can be hard if your title is interim chief.
Yeah,
people are
absolutely
thinking, well, he's only going to be here for a short time, and then you can get a lot of pushback from the people below you. So
yeah. So it could be interpreted either way.
Yeah.
You know who they should get for their surveillance and audio video system is the former lead tech guy for the city of Seattle, who just had an article this week in Crosscut saying that Seattle should embrace the surveillance state. Sounds like he'd be perfect for that.
Yeah, so. He's thinking surveillance of citizens, not surveillance
you're right. Okay.
The police department.
Okay.
So I think they'd be just fine with that at SPD.
Uh-huh. Moving on, they officially announced this week that the $15 an hour initiative in SeaTac won.
It won, yes. And what I find really cool about that is that now the $15 minimum wage, or at least an increase in the minimum wage, has become a national topic. And we have not just the folks in SeaTac to thank for that, but I think also Shama Sawant's campaign, who made that one of their major. She made that one of her major platforms when she was running, and really brought it up as one of the major topics, campaign topics for all city of Seattle races, not just her race and city council races, but also the mayor of Seattle's race.
Yeah,
we
then saw modified versions of that were adapted both by McGinn and by Murray. And so now the pressure is on Murray, and the pressure is on city council to actually do something about that come January.
Yeah. And since it won in SeaTac, there are other localities around the nation now we're talking about raising the minimum wage, whether it's the state of California, whether it's the state of Massachusetts, whether it's individual cities and towns across the U.S., or whether it's in Congress bringing up the issue of maybe it would be a good idea to raise the minimum wage. It's now a national topic, and it's long past time for that to have happened.
Yeah, Obama mentioned in his 2013 State of the Union back in January that he supported a raise of it, the federal minimum wage, to $9 an hour. Now he's come out in favor of $10 an hour, and a lot of the reason for the momentum behind that is what has happened in places like Seattle and New York City and some other locales around the country. The other interesting thing about the SeaTac initiative is it wasn't just minimum wage. It was an entire worker bill of rights that also included things like paid sick leave, mm-hmm. maternity leave, employers not being able to fire without cause, a number of reforms like that other municipalities and jurisdictions are also looking at. And SEIU, which was the union that was the financial muscle behind putting that initiative on the ballot, definitely did so with the idea that that could be a role model for other larger jurisdictions. And above and beyond what Murray and the city council might do this year, there are also plans in the works, from what I understand, to try and launch an initiative for next year if city council doesn't agree to something in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on to national then, some new rules coming out of the Treasury and the IRS.
Yeah, the Treasury Department and the IRS issued new proposed rules for 501c4 organizations. So for folks who don't know what those are, 501c4 is the regulation in the IRS code that allows certain nonprofit organizations to form and engage in a certain amount of political activity for social welfare. The 501c4 section of the code is rather vague in defining what those political activities are, and it allows unlimited lobbying. So many 501c4 organizations, like, for example, Karl Rove's group Crossroads GPS, have formed to collect money and then turn it around and use it during elections to support candidates or particular causes that they want to push.
Yeah, they're not supposed to be involved. They're not supposed to be involved in electoral politics, but lobbying for causes they can do.
Yeah, Tea Party groups have used this in particular to do things like get out the vote drives, to issue voter pamphlets. Their own voter pamphlets saying these are the candidates yes. we support and the causes we support, et cetera.
Yeah, and their position as educational pamphlets so that, for example, people know which candidate is a Kenyan socialist.
Yeah, uh-huh. So that's what they're looking at when they're talking about 501c4 organizations. Now, what the proposed rules would do is that it would classify more political activities as, quote, candidate-related activities that these groups will be prohibited from doing. And some of those, like I said, would be like putting together town hall meetings where you push certain topics onto candidates or where you support certain candidates. It's distributing voter guides. It would be grants to organizations that make candidate-related expenditures. And that's very important because a lot of these organizations don't make direct expenditures to support candidates. They give money to candidates' PACs that then spend money supporting those candidates. It also would prohibit ads from mentioning a candidate within 60 days of an election. Also, a very important thing for them to have included in this. So the proposed rules, I just want to say, are, as I said, proposed rules, which means they could change between now and when they're finalized. There's usually a period of comment, and I think it's very important for folks who want those rules to be tight to make those comments to the IRS and the Treasury Department.
Yeah. And all of this, by the way, a result, of course, of the abuses that have followed the Citizens United ruling. So overturning that ruling would also address a lot of this.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on then. Developments this week with the Steubenville rape case.
Yeah, for folks who weren't or haven't heard of it and weren't following it, this is a 2012 case where a 16-year-old girl in Steubenville, Ohio, was alleged to be raped, and we can now say raped because there have been convictions in the case, at a party at which she basically was passed out drunk, and a number of local football players not only raped her but videotaped it, and it made its way onto YouTube. When this did and the story blew up, the small town in Ohio banded together and rallied behind the football players, which in turn appalled and angered a lot of people. And the local authorities didn't do a whole lot, frankly, until this became a big story. Now, not only has there been convictions in the rape itself, but a grand jury has come back from looking at how the case was handled. And the superintendent of schools for the school district in Steubenville was indicted by the grand jury this week, along with three other people, but the superintendent was the one to be charged with a felony. That was a count of tampering with evidence, along with two counts of obstructing justice, also charged with two misdemeanors of making a false statement and obstructing official business. This came after October indictment of the director of technology for the Steubenville City Schools on charges of tampering with evidence, obstruction of justice, obstructing official business, and perjury. Now, again, You have to ask yourself what sort of manifestation of rape culture would inspire all of these guys, and they are in fact guys, to rally around star football players at a high school to the point of tampering with evidence, obstructing justice, et cetera, all to protect them against charges that they did, in fact, rape this young woman. And there have been some other similar cases in Maryville, Missouri, and some other places around the country where this sort of thing has gone on. And, you know, we saw also, in certainly in the 2012 election, a number of fairly ignorant comments by political candidates around the issue of rape. And you really wonder, you know, 40 years on from when rape and second wave feminism were a big deal in this country, are we really still that uneducated in a lot of different parts of the country, about these issues? And the answer seems to be, well, yeah, we are, yeah, actually.
And this is apparently the way that's going to change.
Moving on, a poll this week regarding immigration reform.
Yeah, actually some good news. A group called Public Religion Research Institute, which is nonpartisan, they do polls occasionally to track people's attitudes towards religion, but also towards public policy issues based on people's religious background to see who supports what kind of public policies. They did a poll regarding support for immigration reform bill. And what they found is that a majority of Americans support legislation that would give immigrants a pathway to citizenship. There was no difference, apparently, what the religious or partisan backgrounds or allegiances were in terms of people's answers to the poll, whether they were Catholic, Protestant, Buddhist, Islamic, Democrat, Republican, or independent. People, a majority of them, want Congress to pass an immigration reform bill that gives immigrants who are here illegally a chance to become citizens. Now, the Senate has passed a bill like that. The Senate bill puts in place a period of about 13 years. It's going to take folks about 13 years to follow the Senate's rules that they have in their bill in order to become a citizen. When Public Religion Research Institute asked people who responded to the poll whether or not they thought 13 years, they told them about the Senate bill that had passed and whether they thought 13 years was a reasonable amount of time. A majority, nearly 7 in 10, said that no, 13 years is far too long to make people wait in order to be able to become citizens. And apparently Republicans, about a 60% majority, Republicans also felt that way. I want to point out notably that that the Republicans in the House, who control the House in Congress, don't want to pass a bill that gives illegal immigrants a chance to become American citizens. Their version of immigration reform would allow them to become legal residents, but not allow them to eventually become citizens. So I think what the poll shows is that a big part of American dissatisfaction with Congress is its inability to get real immigration reform done.
Yeah,
also,
minor modification to that.
Sure.
There actually are the votes in the House to pass the Senate bill at this point. Mm-hmm. The problem is that the leadership of the House, which is specifically to say John Boehner,
yes,
won't bring that bill to a vote.
Yeah.
That's where the hang up is right now.
Yep. Yep. So yes, there is widespread and deep support for immigration reform. Immigration reform that goes the full 10 yards, that says yes, people who are here in the United States, if they've taken the time and gone through the dangers and the expense to get here, they should be given the same kind of opportunities that we and our ancestors had to become citizens eventually. But Congress is not doing that, and I think there's some pretty broad dissatisfaction with Congress over that as well.
All right. On to international, starting with Iran.
Yeah, an agreement this week with Iran to freeze its nuclear enrichment program for 6 months. Now, Iran agreed to, because there's not a whole lot of information on what the actual specifics of that agreement are in the press. There's a lot of back and forth pointing fingers about whether it was a good thing to do or not. What Iran agreed to is to stop enriching uranium beyond 5%, and that's a low level sufficient for use in energy production, but not high enough, not nearly high enough for bomb grade fuel. Iran agreed to dismantle the links between its networks of centrifuges, and that's a step in which they could begin to actually dismantle their enrichment system. Once you start taking down the links, that's the first step. It agreed to stockpile, that its stockpile of uranium that's enriched to 20%, because it does have a small stockpile of that, that's just one step from bomb grade, will be diluted or converted into uranium oxide. It agreed to not install any new centrifuges or start up any newly finished ones or build new enrichment facilities. And it agreed to agreed not to produce fuel for their new heavy water plant at Iraq, which could produce plutonium eventually if it got up to speed, or to even put the new plant into operation. Now, those are pretty strong steps, I think, on the part of Iran. On the other side, the U.S. and the U.N. agreed to the following: to provide about $6 to $7 billion in sanctions relief. About $4.2 billion of that is Iranian oil revenue that was in frozen foreign bank accounts.
So it's their own money.
Yeah, it's their own money essentially, and the bulk of the sanctions will remain in place for now. Now, international monitors will be allowed to visit Iranian nuclear facilities, including the Natanz enrichment plant and the Fordo enrichment plant, which is their underground enrichment plant, on a daily basis, which is a good first step, although it's not the entire inspections program that that the UN would like. Both sides have agreed to disagree on Iran's right to enrich, which is what tanked the earlier talks. Presumably, of course, this will be part of a more permanent agreement, better understanding of whether Iran has a right to enrich or not. And, of course, Israel and U.S. Republicans said that this temporary agreement was a de facto admission of Iran's right to enrich, and so therefore was a bad step. But remember, Israel itself already has nuclear weapons, and so do many other nations in the world, including Pakistan, India, North Korea, and possibly also some other Middle Eastern nations.
And the U.S. has quite a few, too, as I recall.
Yes, the U.S. has quite a few, too, nor are the U.S. facilities and many of these other nations' facilities part of an inspection regime under the UN, under UN auspices. So this agreement is really kind of historic and is unprecedented for a country that already has a nuclear program to freeze its enrichment program and to come under UN inspections, and it's a very good first step.
Yeah. The other thing that's been interesting about this is Maria mentioned the opposition by Israel and by U.S. allies or self-styled allies of Israel in the United States. And a lot of Republican lawmakers, but some Democratic lawmakers as well. Mm-hmm. And this really is, along with the effort to goad the United States into a military strike on Syria last August and some other things, further evidence that what the Netanyahu government and what the government of Israel wants is not necessarily what the U.S. government under the Obama administration does at this point. That there has been a real split there that we have not seen in a long time between what Israel, or at least the government in Israel, perceives itself interested being, and they've been beating the drums for military strikes against Iran. The threats that Iran is days away from a nuclear weapon have been pretty much a staple of Israeli government statements for the last decade at least.
Yeah. And it's become.
It's the boy who cried wolf.
Yeah, well, yeah. And it's become pretty commonly quoted in the U.S. media as well that, this agreement puts back Iran's ability to make a bomb by about a month, and I find that ridiculous.
Yeah, well, and also the assumption, and, we hear this critique on counterspin all the time, where it's put in the U.S., the mention of Iran's nuclear weapons program is not accompanied by the word alleged, when in fact there is actually no evidence that they have ever pursued it, and U.S. intelligence agencies have said there's no evidence of it. So it gets portrayed very, very misleadingly by the media. And again, a lot of that comes from the Israeli government and people in the U.S. who think they're looking out for Israel's interests. And what has happened as a result is Israel has become increasingly isolated. The other piece of this is that Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states also have a large incentive for the U.S. and Iran to be at odds, and they are not carrying the day on this either. So very, very interesting developments in that respect.
All right. And Afghanistan?
Yeah. Loya Jirga was carried out in Afghanistan this week. Now, you know, you may remember that that kind of traditional gathering was also used in 2002 by the U.S. to help create a new constitution for Afghanistan that basically was a U.S.-created constitution. And it included a lot of the sort of traditional warlords that the U.S. had reassured everybody would not be a part of the discussion, even though those were the folks whose mass murders and mass rapes were so bad that it inspired the Afghan people to go with the Taliban in the early 90s. Well, fast forward another decade or so, and there was another one this week considering ratification of the bilateral security agreement that the U.S. is trying to negotiate with the Karzai government in Afghanistan. And surprise, surprise, the warlords and regional chieftains who basically prop up the mayor of Kabul, which is Mr. Karzai, ratified that agreement, but Karzai himself did not. He still wants bans on raids into Afghan homes by the U.S. military. He wants freedom for Afghans from who are being held at Guantanamo. And it was further complicated this week by yet another U.S. drone strike. This one Thursday morning, while people here were getting ready to eat a lot of turkey, there was a drone strike in Afghanistan that killed a toddler and injured two women, none of whom can really plausibly be said to be, you know, terrorist organizers. The U.S. wants this agreement, which would control the presence of U.S. forces in Afghanistan beyond the 2014 that Obama has said he would draw down U.S. forces. They want that signed by the end of next month, by the end of December, the end of the year, which is a very rapid timeline. Karzai, on the other hand, wants it delayed until after the presidential election, at which his successor will be named next April. And part of that, of course, is that he's trying to get his allies to continue in office, and there simply is not the popular support for a continued U.S. presence. So he's trying to delay that agreement until after the election. You don't see a lot of that nuance in U.S. media coverage of this. What you're seeing instead is, well, this Karzai. He's crazy guy. He's asking for these unreasonable things like, you know, civilians not being killed and stuff like that. We can't do that. So it's
not understanding that we do a lot of the same things during our election season here.
Yes. Now, the Karzai has already apparently caved in on the demand that U.S. forces be exempt from Afghan law, which is a huge concession, although that is now currently the case. It's been the cause, again, for a lot of anger in Afghanistan, particularly around the drone strikes and a lot of the military abuses like Sergeant Bates of local Fort Lewis fame. We're probably going to wind up with an agreement by the end of the year, and it's probably going to be forced down Afghans' throats anyway. We'll see how it what the final terms actually are.
All right. Speaking of an agreement, we have about a minute to touch on the climate summit.
Yeah, the climate summit ended in Warsaw, Poland this week. It had been going on for a couple of weeks now. They came up with a dual agreement, a proposed system for pledging cuts in emissions, but not, of course, binding commitments. The U.S. delegate, Todd Stern, proposed a change to the wording to weaken the pledge from commitments to contributions, because I guess you can pledge contributions that you don't necessarily actually have to make.
Heaven forbid.
I know. The second agreement that they came to was a loss and damage mechanism to eventually help the primarily third world or developing nations that are falling victim to climate change. This is what tanked the Copenhagen talks. The U.S. and European countries don't want to have to pay compensation or reparations to countries that are losing territory to rising oceans, or like the Philippines are victims of monster storms. The parties in Warsaw agreed to creation of the mechanism, but not as a new addendum to the treaty. They put it under an existing part of the treaty that deals with adapting to climate change, and no specifics, of course, were hammered out, especially no wording on financial help. What I want to also point out is for the first time, business leaders were invited to sit down. Business leaders and lobbyists for industries were invited to sit down as official participants in the climate talks. And, of course, their input obviously showed with the agreements that were reached.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Tom Chick, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.